if you think we're on the run.
This is episode 19 of the Dad's Army podcast. Thanks once again for joining us.
Your little game. We are the boys who will make you.
As most of you know, we're approaching the 40th anniversary of the programme in July. The very first episode of Dad's Army was broadcast on the 31st of July 1968, and it's really good to be able to look forward to a number of events that are going to be happening over the next couple of months to celebrate that milestone. So we'll be talking about the events that are coming up very shortly. We've received some fantastic emails from you, so thanks guys for sending in all of your emails and all your thoughts about Dad's Army. We'll take a look at what you have been saying. We then got a couple of announcements, and lastly we'll be taking a detailed look at Time on My Hands, where I'll be joined by Paul Carpenter from the Dad's Army Appreciation Society. Firstly then, Crofton Perry Day. Now this is an annual event that takes place up at Brettingham Steam Museum. That's reasonably close to Thetford, it's about 8 or 9 miles away from the town centre, and it's usually a very popular day. Now, in the past, it's been a Dad's Army Day, and it's also been Croft and Perry Day. Well, I think it was actually Perry and Croft Day in 2006, so perhaps that's why Croft gets a mention first this time round. Now, this is an excellent celebration of all that is Perry and Croft, and I think it's true to say there's usually a slight bias towards Dad's Army, mainly because there is a permanent Dad's Army exhibition at the museum, so it's hard to get away from that. But as in 2006, which was when we had the last joint Perry and Croft celebration, there's going to be a number of actors there from different programmes that Perry and Croft had a hand in writing or producing, and I hope to bring you far more details very shortly in a very brief special podcast that should be available this time next week. The event itself is organised by the Dad's Army Appreciation Society, and if you're looking for more information before that special podcast, then you'll be able to find it on the Dad's Army Appreciation Society website, which is www.dadsarmy.co.uk. The town of Thetford, which of course was used for virtually all the location shooting on Dad's Army throughout its 9 years, is also going to celebrate the 40th anniversary. Now this is going to be on the 26th and 27th of July this year. On Saturday evening there's going to be an event called Hits from the Blitz with Jill Daniels, and that's a musical evening that's going to start at 7:30 and continue to around about 11:30. You get your dinner as well, that's going to be a fish and chip supper, which of course for me stirs up memories of Pike's failed attempt to join the army. But it's going to be held in the Guildhall, which of course was Wilmington-on-Sea's town hall and featured in many episodes of Dad's Army. On the Sunday, the 27th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, there's a number of different things going on throughout the town. There's going to be some Dad's Army reenactments by an association called the Western Front. Now, that could be quite interesting, I think. I haven't seen them before. There's also going to be military vehicles on display, themed stalls and displays, and a 1940s exhibition at the Ancient House Museum, and the Charles Burrell Museum will be open. Now, I'm assuming also there's going to be some other bits and pieces there as well, but it may well be worth, if you're free the weekend of the 26th or 27th of July, to visit Thetford. It could be quite a unique celebration of Dad's Army. If you want to find out more information about those 2 days' events or what's planned, then if you go on to www.explorethetford.co.uk and then find the events section, I think that's under a little icon that's called What to Do in Thetford or Places to Go and See, then you'll have all the information and a telephone number to call if you'd like tickets or more information.
You're listening to the Dad's Army podcast with your host, James.
The touring stage play has got an extra day. It's been extended, which is excellent news. The second leg is already considerably longer than the first leg when it started touring the UK in 2007. And an additional day is fantastic. It's great news and it's a good reflection on the show. It's going to be playing at Windsor between the 9th and the 14th of June this year. And the theatre will be the Theatre Royal. And you can find out details about that particular story by going onto our blog, which is www.dadsarmypodcast.blogspot.com. Some more news about the stage play. I managed to catch up with Ed O'Driscoll last week, who's the producer of the show, and I asked him about the future of the play, whether or not there was going to be a third leg, and everything at the moment is very much in the planning stages, but there are plans to take the stage play on the road in 2009, and that will be with some new episodes. So if that does actually come off, and as I said, it's all at a very, very early stage at the moment, then that will be something to look forward to, and by the time it comes to the end of its second leg, it would have been on the road for almost a year anyway, so it's really good that the play is beginning to fit in and become an established part of 21st Century Dad's Army.
Have you taken a look at the new James Beck tribute site? If not, then don't let Walker be lonely anymore and head on over to www.myspace.com/JamesBeck29.
Now, the Dad's Army podcast has had a MySpace page for some time now, and I advertise there in a very low-key way. The web address is www.myspace.com/Dad's Army podcast. And if you take a look at the page at the moment, it's extremely drab and boring. There's very little on it other than the podcast player itself. Now, if you look at some of the other MySpace pages, then they're fantastic. They've got really good graphics, they look good, and it looks like someone's actually spent quite a lot of time and is extremely technically aware to design them. Now, I've had a go at trying to make this page a little bit more interesting. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be working. So here comes the first of my announcements. What the podcast is looking for, what I am looking for, to be more precise, is for someone to volunteer who would like to have a go at redesigning that site, trying to make it a little bit more attractive and hopefully draw a few more listeners into the podcast. So if you're particularly gifted when it comes to designing these kind of web pages and you've got the time to spend doing it, then please get in contact with me. My email address is james@dadsarmypodcast.com. I won't automatically just say yes, anyone can do it, but if you fancy having a go and you want to get in touch, then please do, and it'd be really good to try and work something out to get the MySpace page working as a really good advert for the podcast. So once again, please get in contact with me if you're interested, james@dadsarmypodcast.com. Now, on episode 17 of the podcast, Tony and I discussed the episode Branded. That was a Series 3 episode, and was a slightly more serious episode than most Dad's Army episodes. And I said, I think, on podcast 18 that it generated a significant amount of feedback, far more than usual, and that's continued, and so much so that I've received one email from Arnold Ridley's son, and that's Nicholas Ridley. Now, Nicholas has sent me a long email, and it talks all about Arnold Ridley's involvement in the First World War, because we briefly talked about conscientious objecting and World War One and Arnold Ridley's involvement in it, and he's given me a good history of what actually happened or the experiences Arnold went through. So I'm just going to read it to you without interrupting. Dear James, after listening to episode 17 of the Dad's Army podcast, I thought you might be interested in some further information about Arnold Ridley. As Lance Corporal Ridley, Prince Albert Somerset Light Infantry, the 13th Foot, number 20481, he took part in the Battle of the Somme on the 16th of September 1916. Engaged in hand-to-hand fighting in a German trench, he received a severe blow to the head from a rifle butt, a bayonet wound in the groin, and another through his left hand. As a result of the blow to the head, he was subject to blackouts for the rest of his life. The bayonet wound meant he would also have very little limited use of his left hand. When he regained consciousness, he found himself stranded behind enemy lines. He remained there for 3 days, after which he led a small party of soldiers to the British lines. All the members of the party were recommended for the military medal, the MM, except Arnold Ridley, who, as the NCO in charge, was recommended for the Distinguished Conduct Medal, the DCM. The other members of the party duly received the MM. MMs were awarded to other ranks during the Great War. But Arnold Ridley was turned down for the DCM and received nothing, until, that is, he received the OBE in the 1982 New Year's Honours List for playing a doddery old non-combatant. Concerning conscientious objectors, the following is an extract from the interview Arnold Ridley gave to Peter Liddell in 1971, a recording of which is still held in the Liddell collection, the First World War archives at the University of Leeds. Liddell said, "What did you think about conscientious objectors then?" Ridley replied, "I thought they were quite brave people, but they were badly treated. I think quite a number of people hid behind their conscience, but there are quite a number of people who were genuine. I know one man, for instance, who was very badly treated as a conscientious objector because he wouldn't submit to medical examination. Had he submitted to a medical examination, he would have been grade 99 and they would never have had him. He was half blind and weedy, but he just wouldn't submit to a medical examination on principle. There were some genuine ones, and there were, of course, some rather crafty ones. And that's the end of the quotation from Arnold Ridley. Following the wounds he received at the Somme, Arnold Ridley was invalided out of the army. This didn't prevent him from being presented with a white feather, the symbol of cowardice, in 1917 in Torquay by a young woman wearing a fox fur. He accepted the white feather without comment. He says in the little interview, "I wasn't wearing my soldier's discharge badge. I didn't want to advertise the fact that I was a wounded soldier, and I used to carry it in my pocket." Thank you, Nicholas. That's a fascinating email, and I've learnt more about Arnold Ridley there than a good couple of months trying to find out about the actors on the internet. And I wonder if it is such a coincidence that the story that Arnold Ridley found himself acting was about conscientious objecting, receiving medals, about bravery behind enemy lines, no man's land, fighting. There's an awful lot of parallels there. It must have been quite interesting for Arnold Ridley, and probably quite challenging, to actually play Godfrey's role in Branded.
You're listening to the Dad's Army Podcast. Have you logged on to the Perry and Croft Forum yet? Well, if you are a fan of Jimmy Perry and David Croft's programmes and you haven't taken a look, then you are missing out. But don't panic. You can still join the thriving online community who discuss every conceivable aspect of Dad's Army, Urang Milord, Heidi High and many others at perryandcroft.co.uk and click on the link to the forum.
Just before we get into discussing this fortnight's featured episode, which is Time on My Hands, I'd just like to read an email we've received from Ian Sherwood. Ian has given us a little bit of feedback on what he thinks of Time on My Hands. Hi, James. Saw the note about Time on Your Hands on your blogspot, so have spent a happy half hour watching it tonight. I found myself laughing on a number of occasions. What a great family show Dad's Army is still today, some 30 years later. I recall watching it with my parents and grandparents, and what a joy over the weekend to watch it on TV with my 14-year-old daughter, who went upstairs after watching it and was singing, "Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler?" Well, it is a very catchy tune, and I'm really glad that Dad's Army does appeal to fans of all ages. Anyway, to get back to Time on My Hands, it was good to see Arthur Lowe's wife as a tea shop owner, and I love Mr. Blewett, and that they make a lot of things, them Germans. The scene at the top of the tower, with the cast singing in the moods, was really funny. Add that to the hats getting crushed by the bell clapper and the knights and the Reaper and Corporal Jones, and it all adds up to a very funny episode. Looking forward to hearing other comments on the episode. I'll give it 3.5. Thanks ever so much, Ian, for sending in your feedback there. Now, before we get into discussing this episode with Paul Carpenter this week, I need to just issue a warning. If you're a first-time listener of this podcast, then the standard of the quality of this recording is not usual. It's not particularly good. Paul and I had a nightmare recording things, as you'll find out, and the whole of the last couple of minutes were dropped off, so I had to re-record over that as well. So I do apologise for the quality, and I hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment too much. I'm joined once again by Paul Carpenter from the Dad's Army Appreciation Society, this time to discuss Time on My Hands. Good evening, Paul.
Good evening, Dave. Nice to speak to you again.
Yeah, welcome back to the podcast. This time to discuss an episode that I'll say right up front, I'm not overly keen on.
It's not one of those that gets repeated very often, and I don't think it's one of those that feature in many people's top tens.
Certainly not one that I really enjoyed watching again, but there are some classic lines, and I think in practically every Dad's Army episode, even the ones that I'll probably give a very low score to, there's always one or two little areas that really stand out and make me smile.
There are a couple of lovely little touches.
The episode opens within what we assume is the Marigold Tea Rooms, although it's not referred to by name.
No, I think we can assume it is the Marigold Tea Rooms, yeah. Lunchtime, I'd imagine.
Well, it's funny, actually, because there's a point there that I've noticed. Mannerin mentions, or he says good morning to Ms. Fortescue, who is played by his real-life wife, Joan Cooper. And yet, the minute they run out, and you get a first shot of the clock at the town hall, it's 3:10.
Yes. Mind you, the clock had stopped, hasn't it?
I couldn't remember when that was actually referred to.
The town hall club had stopped because they were going to rip their hands off it, remember, and they said, oh, it hasn't worked.
Yes, indeed. Well, there you are. That's the explanation then. So it must be very close after all. Going back to the opening few moments where Arthur Lowe is served by his real-life wife, she makes a few appearances, doesn't she,
Jane? Oh, yeah, she does. She's made appearances as Mrs. Godfrey, Donny, or Sissy. I think she is.
I seem to remember from watching some DVD extras that Arthur Lowe very rarely travelled without his wife.
Well, that's true. His later acting years, he wouldn't take on the job unless Joan was in the same play, and which is why he didn't do so much, because theatres would only take the one and not the other. So he bypassed those and then would stick to his guns. They're inseparable, I think, near the end.
Was that how Joan Cooper was included in Dad's Army, on Arthur Lowe's request, do you think?
I don't know, really. I suppose she was there. I don't think it was at that particular stage that they would not work together. I don't think she was probably handy to use. I suppose she was an actress, I suppose.
Yeah, no, she was very good. I think she was an actress before Arthur Lowe got into it as well.
Yes, yeah,
it
was, yeah.
She was fairly established. Going back to the actual scene we were discussing, this is a great little scene. I think this is one part that I really do like in this episode. In fact, I think it's probably the scene that I enjoyed the most, where you've got a semblance of normality with Mannering having morning coffee with Wilson. It's almost a serene little moment. And Mannering says, I thoroughly enjoy having morning coffee, don't you? And then really their day just gets much worse as they're interrupted by a variety of people.
That's it. My favourite bit is when Walker comes in, he's delivering something to the Marigold tea rooms, and he asks Mannering to step outside and keep Kaby for him. And he always does, doesn't he?
He does. He almost does it without thinking. And then suddenly checks himself and says, how dare you? And he tries to disassociate himself from Walker's activities on several occasions. It's often referred to that he's actually one of Walker's customers.
Well, he is. I think they're all Walker's customers. In several episodes, he was given tobacco and cigars and drink. And, of course, we later find out he doesn't drink and he doesn't smoke. So the continuity was a bit wrong there.
I always remembered Mannering, certainly within the early episodes, talking about cigarettes, and he was, I think it was in a discussion with Wilson at one point, where he's talking about smoking a cigarette in the house, and
smoked a cigar once, I think.
That was it, yes. And I wondered whether or not that was an attempt to try and, you know, cover up the fact that it was actually his wife smoking a cigar. Or
that wouldn't surprise me.
Anyway, Mannering's refusal to act as a lookout for Walker actually produced one of the lines which we're not too sure whether or not it's correct or not. He refers to himself as the managers of Martin's Bank, whereas, of course, the bank that Mannering manages is established already as Swallow's Bank.
That's it, yeah. I mean, I think the first earlier series they did use Martin's Bank, but I think, if I'm correct, I'm sure some of your listeners would correct if I'm wrong, I think Martin's was an actual bank, and they changed it to Swallow's Bank to avoid any complications, I think.
Interesting change.
I think was it Martin's Bank in the film? I'm not sure.
May have been. It's been such a long time since I've seen the film. I wonder, but you may well be right, yeah. And again, we've had this in the past. There's one particular episode where Mannering is in the tea rooms. He's talking with Mrs. Fox, I seem to remember, and he's interrupted continually by members of his platoon, and it happens again. We've already talked about Walker's entrance. That's followed shortly after by Pike. I have to admit, Pike makes me smile as well. He just comes in and chop chop, quicks the word, off you go.
Come on, Mr. Mannering, better get there quickly. Here's your rifle, Uncle Arthur. Come on, chop chop, sharp's the word, quicks the action.
Just a minute.
And tries to hurry or disturb Mannering from his relaxed, serene morning coffee.
And shortly after that, your favourite comes in, panicking like mad.
Don't panic! There's a Nazi paratrooper dangling from the clock tower of the town hall.
He's dangling. We know, we're just going.
I'll get my rifle and my bayonet, sir.
Don't need your bayonet.
Yes, I do. When he comes down, they don't like it up and then...
Jones doesn't even get any kind of preliminary introduction as a normal person here. His first line is panic from the word go. And what about dangling? But his time is not as ludicrous. I mean, I do smile when he says dangling, and yes, it's...
Always does the dangling, always does the fingers. When everyone says dangling, they always do the fingers.
They do.
I'm doing it now.
and that's true throughout the episode, isn't it? Town Clark does it later on, too.
Town Clark does it as well. Yeah. It's nice, it's a nice little touch. One thing about this episode is if you hadn't seen any other Dazamis, you'd wonder what it was all about, because at no time were they in uniform. And you'd think, well, what's this army business about? Because there's no army in this one, is there at all?
No, that's a very good point, actually. And it's also quite unusual for Dad's Army to rely on continuity. If you can probably think of the number of episodes that refer to incidents in other episodes, on, you know, a number of them on one hand. But this time, you're right, it does actually require, or it assumes, that the viewer is aware of the scenario.
Yeah, and you don't know who's in charge. Is it Wilson who's in charge? Is it Manning who's in charge?
I'm sure Mannerin would say, you can tell by the tone of his voice who's is in charge. But yes, I mean, I'm sure he's referred to as captain or sir at least once or twice.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But you're quite right. It's assuming that the audience is already know the character and knows the setup. So that shows the confidence of the writers by this point, perhaps.
Yeah, they've set the scene, haven't they? They're confident in their writing and haven't even watched it before.
This was the last, I think, in the run of 13 in Series 5, I think, as well. So the remainder of the scenes, it's kind of a strange structure, because in one sense you feel the remainder of the episodes is filmed at the town hall, but there are a few other little scenes that are intercut, and that's the scene with everyone at the foot of the town hall. It's the scene where they're at the bottom of the town hall, but on the interior, just where all the ladders are. And, of course, the majority of the action takes place on top of the town hall.
The next scene was seen on location at the foot of the town hall, which was filmed in Nether Row in Thetford. So we have the scene outside with the public, and I think one of your favourites, Mr. Blewett, makes an appearance.
Yeah, I like Mr. Blewett. I like him in practically everything that he's in, the actual actor, and I really enjoy the character in Dad's Army as well. He's been in a couple of episodes prior to this.
He had, yes. He was in Marble Minor Corporal Jones, I think he first appeared in.
Indeed, and he was also in No Spring for Fraser, which I think was later on in Series 3. And he may have been in a couple of others as well. But he gets a good few lines here, and I have to say that I found his reeling of high-quality German products to be really quite interesting and quite funny.
Certainly
as well.
Certainly wound up with Warden, anyway.
Well, it's not difficult to wind up Hodges, even when he's not in a heightened state of panic. And what gets me is, well, I say it gets me, I suppose it's the consistency of Perry and Croft's writing, is that Hodges is uniformly rude to everybody, no matter whether they're young in the platoon or really old, like Mr. Blewett.
Mm. He was quite rude to Godfrey as well, wasn't he?
I think he did a lot of shouting with Godfrey.
Oh, yeah, he did a lot of shouting.
He told him he was going to shout very loud indeed, and then made his face incredibly thin. quite a talent of Pertwee's there, I think. So, Eric Longworth also gets a good few lines in this episode, and forms quite an important part, I think, of linking the action from outside to inside.
Oh, yes, I think he's established then by that time as almost a supporting actor, isn't he?
Hmm.
That's good, another foil for Mannering.
I think the town clerk here almost takes on a sensible role, because you imagine in the crisis, Mannerman would arrive and he'd say, okay, you do this, this is what we're going to do. Now, I'm afraid at this point, I have to admit, again, this is the second time this has happened when I've been recording with Paul, we had a technical glitch and I'd lost the rest of that particular conversation, so I do apologise if you were getting into the flow of Paul and my conversation. I shall try and continue that conversation, but it won't be anywhere near as informative. The point I was beginning to make, just before I got unceremoniously cut off, as I'm sure Jones would enjoy saying, was that the town clerk almost took on Mannerin's role. Now, you would expect Mannerin to be, you know, in charge of a crisis. Even if he makes some terrible decisions, he would be giving some terrible and incorrect instructions, but he would not be, or very rarely be, distracted from the crisis in hand, whereas this time he does. He gets distracted and he starts talking about Godfrey's air cushion, and it's left to the town clerk to actually bring Mannerin and the platoon back to the plot and the problem in hand, which was how do they get to the top of that tower. Now, for timing reasons, I'm not going to go into dramatic detail on the remainder of the episode. Suffice to say that the majority of it is concerned with talking about how to get the German down, which I think there's some extremely good acting from Christopher Sanford, who plays the German parachutist who gets stuck and caught up on the clock tower. He's the only character in this episode who doesn't seem to be making jokes or taking things not so seriously. I mean, poor guy starts crying when the platoon start singing to him in order to get him to swing. I do quite enjoy the German's role here, particularly when there's a misunderstanding of the word Helfer and Schnell. No, it always makes me smile. I also think Jones, and I did promise that I would get on to talking about Jones, I think Jones in this episode demonstrates every reason as to why I dislike Jones a lot of the time. Absolutely neurotic, absolutely balmy in every shape or form. There's no real depth to the character, he's just very, very silly throughout, and I think this is epitomised when he honestly believes in cutting through a piece of string to get a pole is a good move, despite the fact that the rest of the ladders are tied there. I don't think that the laugh that is generated is worth making Jones look so stupid for. Strangely enough, I could probably see Pike doing something as silly as that, and leaving the platoon cut off from everybody else with no ladders, and I could see him smiling at Mannering going, "I'm sorry, Mr. Mannering," whereas Jones, I just don't think it works brilliantly. I do have to say I enjoy the ending, the way Wilson and the Vicar's idea of getting down from the tower, although it's rather silly, it's good to see Mannering have to eat his hat, well, he would have eaten his hat, perhaps, had he not had it smashed in, through another visual joke, which I think works reasonably well. I think there is something just to be said about the finale of this episode, because I know there was a terrific amount of effort put into making the sets and choreographing the movements of the character, particularly Jones going out on the parapet. He follows the figures that make the journey round the clock every time the bell sounds. I thought originally they were cardboard or had a motor in them, but no, they were actually very small actors. And that, I think, was quite interesting. I had no idea that was the case. Paul also mentioned to me, again whilst I believe we were recording, that on the original VHS copy of this episode, you could see just behind the curtain where those little figures come out from. You could see some either stagehands, or you can see some people who assisted stage preparation and so on. Whereas in the DVD, they've actually changed the camera angle slightly so that that's no longer in shot. And that was news to me, and I thought that was interesting. Last thing to say for me then really is that I thought the ending of this episode was very similar to the sequence shots in Battle of the Giants, where Jones is at the top of the water tower and of course goes dangling out on a flagpole. And indeed I think the special effects methods, which is called colour separation overlay, was used almost in an identical situation with the identical character featuring in the scene in two episodes. So take a look at that as Battle of the Giants and also The End of Time on my hands. Now my score for this was, as you've probably been able to gather, quite low, given that it wasn't one of my favourites at all, and the very heavy Jones presence. I didn't feel this episode was worthy of a very high mark, so I would score this 2.5. However, Paul was a little bit more generous, and he decided that 3 out of 5 was appropriate. So all that's left for me to say is I hope this slightly disjointed review of Time on My Hands hasn't spoilt your enjoyment too much, and I apologise formally once more to Paul for not being able to include the second half of our conversation. That's it for podcast 19. Hope the quality of the last 10-15 minutes or so hasn't got you down too much. Next podcast is going to be out in 7 days' time. It's going to be a mini podcast special, and I'm going to be interviewing Tony Pritchard of the Dad's Army Appreciation Society about Bressingham. So we'll have a good opportunity to discuss what's going to happen at Perry and Croft Day 2008. And I understand Tony's got one or two exclusive pieces of news for you podcast listeners. So make sure you download the next podcast. Should be available on the first Saturday or Sunday in May. The next podcast after that will be all of my recordings that I make at Bressingham. Now, I'm not sure how long it's going to take me to edit everything, because I am expecting to record a fair amount, so it could be a little bit longer than usual. But I am hoping to have everything up and on the website no later than a fortnight or so after Bressingham event has taken place. If it is a little bit longer, then you'll have to bear with me. And if it's going to be significantly longer, then I will put a very brief announcement out on the stream just to say when I expect it to be up and available. Lastly, just to say that I really hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Please send in emails telling us whether you did enjoy it or if you really hated it or couldn't stand the sound quality, then email me in and tell me that as well. James at dadsarmypodcast.com.